My advice for entrepreneurs is definitely to level up with Shopify. The platform is just never a worry. Like, I have so many worries, but the platform is never one. I feel like Shopify really thinks about how they can optimize. It just always feels very ahead of the curve. Everything is just super easy to connect and link. They really know what we need. Time and money that is saved, I can spend on other things and on growth.
Start your free trial at shopify.com.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure: startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach integrier- und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
What's happening in the world right now reminds me of the first time I was in a quarantine. I used to work for an international aid organization. My team specialized in supporting areas affected by severe infectious outbreaks. My first assignment was in the winter of 1994, when we were sent to a secluded town in eastern Russia with a population of roughly 2,000 people. For confidentiality reasons, I won't disclose my organization's name or this town where this incident occurred. The community was suffering from an outbreak being referred to as Pozuoblazin, bubble sickness. Its name derived from the pink and dark grey blister-like lesions that closely resembled bubbles in shape, which broke out across the victim's skin. The sickness also had your classic flu-like symptoms: high fever, cough, body aches, and, in severe cases, delirium. We arrived in town 10 days after the first case was reported. Since then, 57 people contracted the illness, out of which 14 had perished. Our primary responsibilities were to distribute supplies, set up a temporary infirmary, morgue, and implement quarantine protocols. We weren't worried about the illness spreading beyond the town, given how secluded it was, and knew the Russian government would keep the situation quiet. 5 days after my team arrived, the number of cases and fatalities respectively rose to 98 and 29. The town took a more aggressive approach and put a mandatory quarantine in place, prohibiting residents from leaving their homes under any circumstances. Only soldiers, the town's small police force, and my team were permitted outside for door-to-door supply deliveries. Working at the morgue and infirmary, along with testing townspeople to monitor the fever's spread, I became particularly friendly with one woman named Leah, whose home was on my delivery route. She lived on a small farm in the outskirts of town and had an infant son named Alexei. Her husband was working an oil field in Siberia at the time and wouldn't return until the spring. Although her home was out of the way, I always made it a priority to get her anything she and her baby needed, both of whom eluded the sickness. I even gave her a portable radio to contact me directly in case of an emergency. Leah, who spoke English, was endlessly thankful for my help and started giving me little gifts like trinkets and knickknacks she made herself as a token of gratitude. 1 month after we arrived, the sickness only worsened. The number of cases rose to 300, out of which 74 died. My team felt their control of the situation slipping when some of our fellow colleagues became sick, with one dying just a few days after first showing symptoms. The Russian government took matters in their own hands by instating some bold measures. Everybody was to remain in place for 28 days. Anyone caught roaming the streets would be arrested or shot. My team was allowed to continue our routine duties, but were prohibited from venturing outside of the perimeter set up around the town. I was very concerned for Leah, whose house was located just outside the perimeter. The lockdown was instated right before I was supposed to drop off Leah's next round of supplies. Although I pleaded to make one last drop off, government officials making the calls didn't budge. Each supply delivery gave a household about 2 weeks worth of food, water, medicine, and other materials. I feared whatever Leah and her son had left would only last them a few days. Although I was powerless to physically get her any additional supplies, I vowed to maintain radio contact with Leah and kept a log of our conversations. Since it was a portable radio and Leah was low on batteries, we only spoke a few minutes each day. She had to keep the radio off when she wasn't using it to conserve power. Below is my log detailing some of our interactions over this 28-day period. Day 4. Leah thinks she has roughly 5 to 7 days of supplies left for her and Alexei. If she rations everything properly, Leah believes she could last up to 10 to 12 days. "I'm concerned about my baby," she said, the fear very apparent in her voice as it crackled through the radio. "There has to be something you can do for my baby boy." Despite her looming shortage of necessities, Leah said she nor Alexei were exhibiting any symptoms. She was keeping herself busy by crafting more trinkets and knickknacks. Day 9. Leah thinks she underestimated how much food she had left for Alexei. She's down to 2 jars of baby food, 1 packet of formula, and had run out of clean diapers. She cried to me for the first time today. The fear and uncertainty in her voice was so disconcerting and surreal, it prompted me to take action. I quickly forged a plan to get Leah and her son the supplies they sorely needed. Before I was set to embark, however, a vicious blizzard rolled in that blanketed the region with over 3 feet of snow. The quarantine prevented any roads from being cleared, making Leah's home physically inaccessible. I still get haunted by the sounds of her hopeless weeping when I told her the news. There was one particular remark she said that sticks with me to this day. "Perhaps my son and I weren't meant to overcome this dark time. If the sickness does not kill us, we may be condemned to a death of much greater suffering." Day 11. Another 2 feet of snow fell last night. The town is practically buried. I don't even think people can get out of their homes if they tried. The snow has made our job a lot more difficult since the roads aren't being shoveled. To me, the snow personifies my mounting dismay and despair of helping Leah and her baby. The feeling of powerlessness is absolutely smothering. I broke down when I last spoke to Leah. She's so scared. Although she understands why I cannot reach her, part of me can't help but blame myself for her current predicament. Day 14. Leah has run out of supplies for herself. The fact she was able to make what little she had last this long was remarkable, and certainly a testament to her perseverance. She said Alexei only has a few spoonfuls left of baby food. She has no formula, no diapers. The baby was constantly crying when I spoke to Leah. Every sob and whimper sent sharp chills down my spine and formed knots in my stomach. I'm unsure how effective this quarantine is, since the number of cases has risen to 900, nearly half the town. Fatalities are at 350. This disease spares no one, but I'm at least thankful it hasn't reached Leah and Alexei. Perhaps living among the outskirts of town was a blessing for them in that regard. But like Leah said, it could be a precursor to a more agonizing demise. Day 15. Leah fed Alexei the last of his food. They're now both completely out of supplies. She spent our conversation weeping and blaming herself for putting her son through this, and kept asking why she wasn't more prepared. I tried comforting her, but Leah was inconsolable. I haven't slept the last 2 nights. I can't get Leah and a baby boy off my mind. The trepidation, guilt, and sorrow has weighed heavily on me, especially since our radio interactions don't feel nearly as reassuring. I haven't eaten much lately. It doesn't feel right knowing people like Leah and a baby don't have access to the same means. Part of me hopes I do contract Pazir Belazen, so I don't have to listen to their suffering. Day 18. Leah said it's been 5 days since she's had anything to eat. 3 days for the baby. "All I want is to end my baby's suffering," Leah sobbed to me when we spoke that day. "I don't care if I make it out of this alive, I just want Alexis' suffering to stop. Why must someone so new on this earth have to be dealt life's most unforgiving hand? All I can do is tell Leah to take things one day at a time and assure her everything will be fine. I know Leah can sense the false hope in my voice. The baby's cries sound like hollers of sheer agony that grow worse every day, like the poor child is being physically tortured. A little piece of me dies every time after Leah and I speak. Part of me wonders if this subjugation to Leah and a baby's continual suffering is punishment for some misdeed I've previously committed. I don't know what I could have said or done to deserve such a demoralizing penance. Day 19. I think Leah is taking a turn for the worse. She aimlessly babbled about how hungry she was, or making new trinkets and knickknacks, and anticipating the return of her husband from Siberia. "All he does is cry," Leah said when I asked about the baby. "I left him in his crib upstairs so I can have some solace from his infernal shrieks and cries. I can't do anything to ease my child's pain. I have accepted that reality. Although he grows weaker by the day, but his cries are becoming more piercing and unbearable. I'm just so hungry too. So hungry." Leah's voice was very hoarse and weak. She claims they aren't sick, but would welcome the illness at this point, which she described as liberating. There are now over 1,000 cases. Hundreds have died, including members of my team. The infirmary and morgue are both at capacity. Any new cases have been ordered to self-quarantine in their homes. Bodies are starting to pile in the snow next to the morgue. How I haven't caught this illness is either a miracle or catalyst prolonging my torment. Day 24. I haven't heard from Leah in days. Today, she finally responded. "Alexei is dead. My baby boy is gone." That was all she said. Day 26. I managed to get in touch with Leah, but she was completely despondent. She just sobbed and rambled incoherently, constantly shifting between English and Russian. From what I could make out, Leah kept lamenting about a baby dying and proclaiming herself a failure as a mother and wife. Earlier in this quarantine, I would have been beyond distraught over what Leah's lost, but felt completely numb, almost emotionless when we spoke. All I did was give Leah the same empty assurance that everything will be fine in a flat, robotic voice. I reminded her that quarantine was ending in 2 days, after which I would immediately come to her house with supplies. She didn't seem to care or listen, probably because she knew I didn't even believe my own words. The illness didn't have to infect everyone to inflict pain. What I experienced here will plague my memories for years. Although I'm surviving, I've been long dead on the inside. It's amazing Leah has managed to go this long without food. I sincerely hope she doesn't succumb to the heaviness of losing a child and give up, especially with 2 more days left. She has to remain strong to keep a child's memory alive. Day 28. The quarantine has finally been lifted, but it's still going to take some time before I can reach Leah's farm. The number of new cases is slowing, but the death toll has exceeded 700. More than 75% of the town fell ill. It's hard to say if the quarantine truly worked, but we're confident the town will eventually recover. We worked frantically to dig out the town streets and start getting supplies to households. I tried radioing Leah, letting her know the quarantine is over and I would be at her house as soon as possible. She never responded. It took another 2 days before I finally got to Leah's farm. I and two of my colleagues rushed over to her house with a full replenishment of supplies. The front door was unlocked, and when we first stepped inside, we were hit with a wall of putrid stink, containing the distinct odors of feces and decay. Bundles of used diapers, rags and clothes were piled in a few room corners. Some sections of walls were covered in deep scratch marks, holes, along with smears of what appeared to be blood. The house was in varying degrees of disarray, looking like Leah threw a massive tantrum and destroyed parts of her home in the process. We found Leah curled up in the corner of a living room. She was mired in filth, looking like she hadn't bathed or slept in days. She surprisingly wasn't as frail as I anticipated from malnourishment, but was completely checked out mentally. Leah seemed to recognize me and signaled she wanted to give me something she was tightly clenching. When I extended my hand, she dropped a small white trinket in the shape of an A that was about the size of a quarter. "I made them to keep my son's memory alive," Leah said weakly, who was in a deep trance when she spoke to me. "Promise me you'll keep it and always have a piece of my baby boy that stays with you." The A was intricately carved and felt smooth to the touch. I was actually impressed by its flawless shape of white, which almost made it look professionally done. It looked to have been carved out of marble or ivory. The hardest part came next when I asked Leah where her baby's body was located. She started fiercely sobbing and trembling before shakily pointing towards the kitchen. A knot formed in my stomach when I started easing toward that part of the house where my colleagues tended to Leah. Amidst the nauseating stenches filling the house, I quickly distinguished the aroma of rot and decay that was exclusively associated with death. The kitchen was as bad as the rest of the house, with empty cans, broken dishes, glasses, along with soiled clothes and other unidentifiable stains and smudges strewn across the floor, table and counter. Burying my nose in a cloth to withstand the stomach-churning smell, I walked up to the table, where a half dozen other A's lay clustered next to some rags, tools, another small stack of white porcelain shards that I presumed Leah used to craft the trinkets. A sharp, sinking feeling befell me when I noticed a dish at the head of the table that was covered with blackish red smears. The utensils were also covered with the same substance that I willfully remained ignorant on identifying. I noticed a cluster of flies congregated over the sink. I shuddered upon seeing what was inside. 4 limbs, no less than 5 or 6 inches, that were completely stripped of their flesh, except for the tiny hands and feet at the end of each limb, which are unmistakably an infant's. "Please no," I murmured, while fighting the urge to vomit and acknowledging my worst suspicions were confirmed. I violently turned away from the sink, starting to keel over slightly in anticipation of vomit, and it was then my eyes were drawn toward the oven, where another cluster of flies were buzzing around, and the stench of death was strongest. My limbs trembling, I slowly stood upright and crept toward the oven. Although I refrained from inhaling, I still felt the warm, grimy wall of decaying odor rush out as I opened the oven, inside of which lay Alexis' head and limbless torso. The body was burnt to a crisp and was the same red color as the smears on the dinner plate. While initially feeling sorrow and remorse, those sentiments were replaced with repulsion and sheer terror when I noticed the chunks of flesh had been removed from the body with surgical precision, and parts of the baby's featureless torso were stripped of bare bones. This appalling sight, one I can still clearly visualize after all these years, made me face the morbid truth I desperately tried denying, but explained why Leah managed to survive this long without food. She ate her baby. My breathing was reduced to short, gasp-like breaths as a wave of panic swept over me, during which I swiftly turned away from the sanguinary sight and looked back at the table, where I noticed another unsettling detail before storming out of the house. A closer look at the small stack of porcelain shards that Leah used to shape her trinkets affirmed there was something else. Pieces of skull, ribs, and spines. I retrieved the A-shaped trinket Leah gave me, staring at it in sheer horror and disgust before chucking it across the kitchen. The trinkets were composed of bone. She was using her dead infant's child's bones to craft these ornaments. Leah's words, "You'll always have a piece of my baby boy that stays with you," and what she literally meant rang through my head as I bolted outside and retched profusely. I refused to re-enter the house and never saw Leah again after that fateful day. I don't know what became of her, but heard whispers she descended to a point of uncontrollable insanity and was placed in an institution. I refused to ponder whether Leah waited until her baby died or if she put him out of his misery. In the end, 1,600 people fell ill to Bezier Belizen. The final death toll was 808. I don't remember how much longer I spent in that town, but was eternally grateful when we finally left. Although I've been told there was nothing I could have done to save Leah and her son, I still suffer from insurmountable guilt and am ruthlessly haunted by these memories. Things may be bleak now, but I can assure that very few, if any at all, have endured the experiences I faced during my first quarantine, and hope none of you ever do.
We always recommend Shopify. It took us from an idea to a real business. We got set up, I think, in less than a day. With very little effort, we could just focus on the supply chains and the product development. Shopify gives us the ability to customize without the complexity. We can change something without introducing fragility or having to pay a developer. We're Thirsty Turtle, and we leveled up our business with Shopify.
Start your free trial at shopify.com/au.